I always like to talk about humor because I think it's rather ignored and insulted. And
thank
so,
you for saying that. Yes.
So I'm going to be talking with Eden Robbins today on I Should Be Writing Season 18, Episode 67.
Well, I should be writing. I should be working on my craft. I should be writing. I should be submitting my next draft. But I'm sitting home watching Doctor.
Yeah, hi there. Welcome to I Should Be Writing. This is the podcast for wannabe fiction writers, and I'm your host, Mer Lafferty. And I've been doing this since 2004, and I've been writing professionally since 2011. And my newest book, Station Eternity, just came out. It's very exciting. Ooh. So those are my credentials. I've started trying to do those since a lot of people don't seem to be doing writing advice without any credentials, so I'm trying to remember to put those in there. Even though it's really hard with imposter syndrome and stuff for me to toot my own horn, but there it is.
Yeah.
For what I've been up to, I'm doing brainstorming on my NaNoWriMo project, and I'm really happy with where it's going. I have a title, I have a rough plot, and I think the concept is weird enough to make people interested, so I think I'm now all that's left is sitting down and actually writing it, so we'll hope. I'm not a good outliner.
The easy part.
Yeah, the easy part, exactly. I'm not a good outliner. I talk about that a lot. I'm going to try to do a quick outline just to tell my agent what I'm up to, but I have no idea if I'll stick to it. We'll see. We'll see. Eden, you want to tell us what you're working on right now?
Sure. My first novel, When Franny Stands Up, is coming out literally a week from today.
That's
so
right.
Mostly what I'm working on is sending a million emails all the time.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of short essays about the book. But I'm also writing a second book that I am sort of in between drafts on. I'm very excited about. It's going to be very different, a little bit of a non-traditional narrative. Let's call it a kind of funny book about death.
Oh, excellent. I just did a daily show about death. I would love to talk about death.
Oh, always. It's so nice to talk to people about death, because a lot of people, you bring it up and it's like you're suddenly the end of the party.
Yeah, but I mean, among writers, it's like, a lot of people love to write really depressing stuff about death, and those win literary awards. So,
of course,
they should love to talk about it. I like to talk about the episode I did was talking about how we managed to do funny about death, and so mm-hmm. I'll like to talk about that in a little bit. But first, I want to get to good news. Do I have good news? I've been the pets have a very quick adaptation. They're very good at adapting to whatever's going on. Last Monday my dog blew out her other knee while the first knee is still healing from surgery. It's been rough, but and no pun not intended. But it's we got a harness for her. Her pain's moderated, so you know, she was just like, I have no idea how to walk and everything hurts again, what's going on? And you know, once we got her used to walking with the harness, and she could walk around the room a little bit because we're supposed to be encouraging her to exercise that weak leg, she's doing better. She's more cheerful. I had to stop her from playing this morning. She really wanted to play. She's walking more on the leg, and we're just waiting till she can get the surgery for the other leg, and then we go through all of this again. But she's only got two knees to injure, so she's done. She's gone through them both.
That's a good spin.
I try. I really try. The honest thing is, this is a fixable problem. We have pet health insurance, so it's not going to be a huge financial hit. And, you know, it's not cancer. It's not going to kill her. It's something she can come back from. So we're trying to be positive in that way.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Still sucks.
Yes. Well, we lost our other dog to lymphoma earlier this year. No. So it's like we know what can happen when just things start to go downhill. And now I'm just being a real big downer. Other bit of good news, I am actually excited about this novella. I'm having that magical brainstorming feeling where you're like, I don't know what's going to happen at this point. And then it almost feels like a puzzle piece snapping into place once you realize what can fit there. And it's a really good feeling.
Such a good feeling.
I usually get it when I'm writing, but now I'm getting it while just brainstorming, and that's nice. Maybe I'm growing. I don't know. if you guys have any good news, please put it in the chat. And Eden, do you have any good news to share? If you don't, that's cool. But if you do, we'd love to hear it.
Well, you told me that rejections count as good news.
Mm-hmm.
I got two rejections from residencies.
Oh, wow.
Just this past week. I have yet to crack the code of the residency. Writing an author statement is like, just eludes me. So I keep trying and I keep getting rejected, but we'll call it good news.
Great. I am about to set up our yay button. We don't have yay button right now because behind the scenes streaming things. If folks have good news, boy, I'm just so annoyed at how everything's turned out today. Sorry. Two rejections for Star Eyed Green. That's fantastic. Eden, we're also happy to welcome you to Team Rejection because it is something we have been counting throughout the year. Team Rejection is up to 346. And
fabulous.
Now we're going to be adding to it. Let's see if this works. Okay, cool. There's that rejection. And then two for Star Eyed Green. There we go. Okay. One rejection for Underpope. Congratulations.
Woo-hoo.
Yes, yes. Yay button in chat for the rejections because I don't have the confetti. No, wait. Do I? Maybe I do. Look at that. I do have the confetti set up. Awesome. Awesome. Cheers and confetti for all the rejections. What did I get? Kimmy got rain. Let's see. Joey T. Badger is here. Hello. Everybody follow Joey T. Badger. His streams are lots of fun. Added on the rejections. Did I do two for you or three or one for you? We'll do
for
one
me?
More.
Why not?
You said two, right?
I did, yeah.
And I'm sorry that sucks, but you know, there are a bunch of people out there who think, who am I to apply to these things? So I'm not going to do it. And you did, so.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, like, I'm just, rejection always sucks, but it's also, I'm used to it. So it's just part, it's just like, it's not a failure of the system. It's part of it.
Yes, exactly. And you know, as I co-edit a short fiction market with the kids are asleep in chat. And a lot of times when it's like people try to do the rejectomancy and try to figure out what it really means. Honestly, when it says this isn't right for us, that's what it means.
Yep.
Really?
I used to edit a short fiction magazine also. And it's really illuminating. I think everybody who tries to write fiction should edit at some point so you can see there's not like some evil cabal of like people trying to get you or who think you're a bad person. It's just like, this is good. Like, this is good. It's just not for us.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, the team rejection is not going up, Kay Kimmy. Thank you for pointing that out. Oh boy. I don't even know. It's automated, which means I would have to fiddle with something. So if somebody could just write down how many that was, I'll fix it when I'm not live. I would appreciate that. Whew, this just... We are live. Video and audio is working.
And that's what's
we're
important.
We're here. And that is what is important. So, we're very happy to have you on the show and talk about your book and humor and death, apparently, which I'm really looking forward to. So can you tell us about When Franny Stands Up?
Sure. The briefest elevator pitch I can give is that it's a queer, marvelous Mrs. Maisel where jokes are magic. I set out to write a comedy about trauma. As you can tell, I really like the dark stuff. And I like to try and figure out, good ways to make it funny. The brief synopsis is basically, it's just after World War II in Chicago. During World War II, when men went off to war, male comedians and entertainers also went off to war. And so stand-up comedy became a thing that women did. And women developed a kind of magic called a showstopper, which is unique to each comedian. And it's sort of a feeling that is evoked in their audience when they laugh. It's different for everyone. The most famous comedian gives her entire audience an orgasm. I hope I can say that here.
Yeah.
And then the least famous comedian makes you feel the satisfaction of arriving at the bus stop just as the bus arrives.
That's not a bad feeling.
It's not, it actually feels really good, right?
Yeah.
So the main character, Franny, basically her brother came home from the war with PTSD. It's changed the whole family dynamic. She's dealing with her own traumas or not dealing with them very well. And she ends up falling into stand-up comedy and sort of discovering how to heal herself and the people around her. And all kinds of hijinks ensue.
Well, I have so many questions. I'm so excited
about this.
It's okay. So, as I write humor, my first two books were like funny urban fantasy, and then I started writing darker stuff, but the humor's still in there. I just have to kind of couch it in serious crap every once in a while.
Sure.
But, I do know it's tough, and I do know that unless your last name is Pratchett or Adams and they're not alive anymore, it's really hard to be taken seriously as a humor writer. John Scalzi writes funny stuff, but I don't know if anybody would say he writes like specifically, like it's always funny. Or if you think of the humor writers, it's hard. It's really hard. And, you do automatically get kind of labeled as well, you're not serious. And it's hard to make people laugh, but what else is difficult? And I know a lot of really good writers who struggle with this. I don't even know if they know they struggle, but they struggle with me as a reader. And that is when people in a book respond to something they think is funny. If the reader doesn't think it's funny, it reads very awkward. Am I the only one who feels like this?
Nope.
Okay. Because, I'm reading something about people like roaring with laughter, tears streaming down their face. And I'm like, maybe I just had to be there, but this is not funny. And this reads very awkwardly. So you're writing about stand-up comedy. Mm-hmm. So how are you fitting that into the book and getting the responses that you want from both the reader and the audience in the book?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question because I really struggled with because the book is about stand-up comedy, but nothing brings a plot to a screeching halt like a bunch of jokes.
Yeah.
So I really struggled with the balance of how much actual stand-up comedy do I put in this? Not to mention the fact that comedians repeat jokes at different shows. Mm-hmm. So this is all about a person who's learning the art of stand-up comedy. And so I kind of, there's a little bit of here's a joke in the moment. And yes, there's a little bit of the audience laughing. And because it's the 1950s, it might actually not be hilarious to a reader. But I tried to make those minimal and I tried to have more going on in that scene than just the joke.
Mm-hmm.
Also, what was really important to me about the stand-up comedy that I don't see in books or movies and stuff is the creative process and how it works.
Oh, excellent.
And that when you start learning a new creative art, you're not good at it. And it doesn't go like day one, you're not good at it. Day two, oh my God, you're a genius. And like, even the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel show I love does a lot of that. So I was like, how do I incorporate the sort of fits and starts of the creative process and like really honor that process that I love? And I think is kind of magical in this book without it being boring. So this is a long answer to your question, but like the comedy is part, like stand-up comedy is part of it, but it's really more about the creative process and how you learn a new skill and art and who helps you along the way.
Yeah. A lot of people think that humor is, you know, you either have it or you don't. And granted, there are people who are naturally funny, but it is all of that stand up or writing or however you're presenting your comedy has to be practiced and has to be refined. I know I've heard stand up comedians like, you know, they have to practice their timing perfectly.
Yeah.
You know, that's not only just writing, but it's also performing. I mean, would Stephen Wright have been as funny if he hadn't been so deadpan?
Right.
Kind of like that. But I'm really glad you go into that because it is difficult, but it also, it does blow that idea of you either have it or you don't out of the water because, you know, people who are really good at drawing still take art classes, you know, to
Absolutely.
Refine things and learn about light and whatever the people in art look. I don't know. I'm not an art student. I know they go
no,
to school.
But I think you're right though, because there's this idea that when you learn, once you've like kind of learned how to do something, that there's no more learning to do, that you're like an expert. And there's almost this weird pride of like not having to take classes or not having to learn more. And I think that's really unfortunate because I think if you're going to be an artist, that you have to keep that curiosity and that willingness to kind of have a beginner mind, even when you're an expert. And what's interesting to me about humor that you said that people think you either have it or you don't, I think where people get really hung up is trying to anticipate what other people are going to think is funny, or trying to reuse almost like humor cliches. But I think being funny and sort of mastering humor is all about knowing yourself and what you think is funny and the specificity of your experience. And when you can really be honest with yourself about that, that's when you really can access this humor. And that's something you can learn. I think it's true of writing too.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
How does that translate when you're, I'm thinking specifically about the the British office and the American office, where the stars are specifically dedicated to, they think they're the funniest things ever and they're not. And the humor is watching, I guess the humor is watching other people react to it.
Right.
And usually not laughing unless they are sycophantically laughing. Is that an adjective? Sure.
Yeah. Yes, it is now.
Yes, it is now. You knew what I meant, then it's a word.
Yep.
How do you approach humor like that? Or do you? I mean, that's a different kind of awkward type humor.
It is. Well, the characters are characters, so they're written by somebody else to be funny. But what's funny about them is that they have such a lack of self-awareness. And I think the other thing is that we all know people who have that extreme lack of self-awareness, and it's not really funny to be around them. It's like kind of stressful. Maybe I'm just speaking for myself.
No, you're absolutely.
It's stressful, but when you see that play acted, it can be a kind of catharsis and it can be funny. And I think that not to jump the gun here, but like the thing about humor that's so important to me is how you can kind of remake these bad experiences or traumatic experiences and sort of shuffle the pieces around and make it funny and find catharsis in that humor. And I think that what you're talking about is one small example of that.
Interesting. Yeah, I just took Brent Forrester's comedy screenwriting class.
Oh, nice.
And he does it every couple of months, and it's like $100 for 2 hours
Wow, really?
For 5 weeks.
I'll write that down.
Yeah, it's not a lot of money for what you get. It's amazing. And he wrote for The Office and King of the Hill and The Simpsons. And anyway, he said, write from your trauma. He was in a writer's room where people would walk in and say, all right, what happened this past weekend? And somebody would say the fight they had with their spouse or, you know, other bad things that happened. And the room would make it funny. And while that sounds really stressful work environment for me, you know, I'm not ready to laugh about the fact that my wife walked out today. Yep. But, you know, that's where a lot of humor comes from. And I thought about, I don't feel ready to talk about it, but there's something my sister and I used to laugh at a lot because we had to otherwise. It was, you know, it's not terrible, but just more of a family specific thing that we used to joke that if certain people would when certain people died, we would go on Oprah, and now that person is still alive and Oprah's gone. So
too late.
We're not sure where to take our story. But, so when I was thinking about that, I thought, well, maybe I'll put that into a story. And that really helped flesh out the novella I was talking about. So, you know, bringing my personal issues and trauma into it was a useful step. So I'm really glad you mentioned that. How do you access that with humor instead of with getting upset about it?
Well, I mean, I think you have to be, it's like you said, you have to be ready, you have to be willing, you have to want to process trauma or a bad experience in this way. Like, I'm a pretty private person, and I really kind of, it makes me a little nauseous, like very, you know, other people, whatever, they love to do it. But like for me, writing a very personal essay about like super, super private stuff, that's just not going to be cathartic for me. That feels like exposing myself in a way that I'm just not comfortable.
Yeah.
But there are things in my life that humor, it's almost like a gentle way of exposing yourself. And I mean that in a metaphoric way, not like, please, literally. But like, it's kind of like, okay, you can look at the thing that happened to you as an object and kind of three dimensionally. And be like, what's a different perspective on this that I haven't considered? And a lot of times that different perspective has some humor in it because the bad things that happen to you have a kind of their own energy, you know, it's like they're powerful because obviously they're upsetting to you. And if you can see it from a slightly different perspective and bring in some humor, it's both gives you a little bit of distance, but also helps you process it differently. So like for an example is I took a stand-up comedy class as research for this book. And it's a wonderful thing for a writer who's a control freak because you really like obsess. It's like you said, tone, every single word. Like I said, it was the hardest writing I have ever done.
Wow.
And it was like a 5-minute set. But the teacher I had, whose name is Alex Kuman, she's a comedian. She's very funny. You should find her on Instagram and elsewhere. we basically took these experiences from our lives on a theme and then tried to connect them together and figure out the patterns and write jokes from that. So these experiences that I had not really processed from my past, but like definitely hurt me at the time, I was able to be like, oh my gosh, this weird breakup of this like anti-Semitic ex-boyfriend, I can look at that differently now and be like, well, that was a weird first breakup. And I can connect it to some of these other stories in my life. And in making those connections, it made me feel like my life was a tapestry of experiences versus like this trauma and this trauma and this trauma, you know? So it helped me process in a different way.
Excellent.
Yeah.
In chat, Kids Are Asleep, also a very funny writer. Humor can defang or depower things that are sad or scary. Yes. Definitely agree about that.
I think it can also add a different kind of power to them. I totally agree. It makes them less scary for sure, but it's very empowering to be the one to own the humor of something bad.
Yeah. Yeah, ownership is an interesting
Yeah.
concept when it comes to humor.
Totally.
I mean, I know that it's in one way, it's a different way of just saying punching up or punching down what kind of jokes you own, but also owning a story that is traumatic. Hadn't thought about it that way. That's really interesting.
Punching up plays a big part in the book as well, which was an interesting thing to do in a book that takes place in the 1950s, because you can't write a book about the 1950s without talking about oppression and all the various flavors of that goes on.
Yeah.
So trying to write that for a modern audience and punch up, you know, was a big part of stuff that I was thinking about the whole time.
Yeah. A thing you can explain is a thing you feel you can control, more so if you can laugh at it. Okay.
Absolutely.
So it's things that are sad or scary, and laughing at them is the perfect segue to talking about death. if you guys don't know, I have been doing a daily podcast to try to get in shape for NaNoWriMo, because I'll be doing a daily NaNoWriMo podcast for Patreon supporters. Wow. Next month. You can support at $1. Really, it's pretty cheap for a ton of content. But there's my little commercial. But a recent one I did was about death, because I've just been, you know, I watch a lot of cozy mysteries. I'm pretty much writing cozies in space now. And
love it.
The cozy itself is just bizarre, that you can have this feeling of comfort and knowing what to expect while still being about a murder. And granted, I know one thing that make cozies perfect is they are, you know, the murderer is going to get caught or get their comeuppance at the end. It's not going to be, they're not going to get away. There's not going to be any sort of sour taste to whatever they left behind kind of thing. It's just an open and shut case. And usually the sleuth is adorable. But you're still talking about death, and you still have to figure out a way to laugh at it. So, I talked about narrative distance to the person who died. But I wanted to know how you approach that.
Well, death, I mean, I think we're all looking for safe ways to approach death. Death is the ultimate mystery, right? And it's the ultimate thing that we cannot, does not matter what we do, how hard we try, what century it is, we can't control death.
Yeah.
And I think that the cozy mystery is definitely one sort of like safe approach to explore death. I've actually noticed recently, I don't know if anybody else has noticed this, but I feel like people have really, really amped up their Halloween decorations in the past couple of years, like really in a serious way, at least in my neighborhood.
Yeah, mine too.
And I think that people are grappling with death right now with, you know, as we're still sort of slogging through this pandemic, and Halloween decorations and Halloween are one way to kind of safely grapple with it. because we don't have a culture that gives us space to grapple with death or to grieve or to any of these things. How I approach it is that it's absurd. Our fears of it are absurd. It's coming for all of us. And I find sort of a comfort in that, in a way, because the things that seem like they really matter don't really matter. And that means that you can kind of play around with what can be funny. I'm just now starting to write about death, and it really started during the pandemic when I was having a lot of trouble writing. I've been writing obituaries, fake obituaries, for this new book that I'm writing. And it has been a really interesting way to kind of explore other people's stories and dig into their lives. Obituaries have gotten funny. A lot of them, the funny ones have gone viral, and it's become this sort of like the people's art form in a way, and a way to sort of memorialize somebody with the personality that they are known for. So it's been a fun medium to explore death.
Are they writing their own?
Some people write their own obituaries before they die. Some people write obituaries about their family members. Some of them are funny. Some of them are mean. Like, there are mean obituaries about people. And then, of course, there's the ones in the newspapers and online. There are some papers that are traditionally known for writing funny obits. So The Telegraph is known for their sort of snarky obituaries. And so it's been interesting to see like how the different venues approach death and how you can be kind of irreverent about this thing that is so scary and mysterious.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm just absorbing. That's
No, it's fun. It's so fun to talk about death. I know that's a really weird thing to say, but it's so taboo. And I don't know, it just really makes me want to dig in more. You know, like what's the nature of this taboo? What are people's fears specifically? You know, how do other people cope with it? There's this theory that one of the ways that humans have evolved to have a knowledge of our own mortality is that we co-evolved this denial of our own mortality, which I think is really fascinating, because the idea is that like other species, like there's no reason that an elephant couldn't have evolved a knowledge of their own mortality, but without that co-evolution of denial, like what's the point of doing anything? So we've sort of like, you know, I think that's an interesting idea that I hadn't considered.
So beating death either literally with technology, like I think Steve Jobs was trying to, actually, no, he was trying to do it with holistic medicine or herbs, or beating it in a metaphorical way of building something amazing and leaving a legacy behind.
Right. A legacy. I have a complicated relationship to the idea of legacy, because in a way it's like, you know, if you go camping, there's a leave no trace philosophy, right? Mm-hmm. Where like you pack everything out with you, and it's sort of wonderful to have experienced a place and then like there's nothing of you left behind. Mm-hmm. So in a way I'm like, well, that's kind of wonderful too. Like you get to experience everything that life has to offer. Lucky you. And then why not leave no trace? Like, is there anything so great about like carving your name into the world? I don't know.
Well, there's also the legacy of affecting people. You know, if you helped someone along the way, you made a difference in someone's life. That's also a kind of legacy.
Granted, absolutely.
Eventually, enough people will die that you won't be remembered unless you're like in the history books. But then you're probably famous for doing what you just said. So, it's. There are different ways to leave legacies, but that is a good point. It's kind of the theme, and it's kind of something you uncover. So this is a slight spoiler, but oh crap, Becky Chambers' novella with the tea monk and the robot, A Prayer for the, I can't remember the Prayer for the Crown Shy. No, I'm mixing them up, aren't I? Anyway, I'm sure someone will correct me in chat. A big message of that is, do you have a purpose, and do you have to have a purpose? Mm-hmm. And that was really, really, that really had me thinking a lot. And sorry for the slight spoiler there, but
I like that a lot. I like it, even if the answer ultimately is yes, to take this sort of common thing that we all agree on, and then I'd be like, is that actually true? Is one of my favorite things to do. I think it really opens up interesting discussions.
Okay.
So now you've got me thinking.
Excellent. We got, okay. Yes. I was mixing up the first and second book. It's A Prayer for the Wild Built, and that's the first one. And the second one is A Psalm for the Crown Shy. I got it.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Very pretty titles that I can't remember at all. So I'm just going to say Becky Chambers' new novella series. So Psalm for the Wild Built. Isn't that what I said? Yeah. Anyway, thank you all thank you, Glenn and Lee, for helping me out there. But yeah, that concept of legacy, or do you have a purpose, was a major theme in that, at least the first one. I haven't read the second one yet. Mm. So tell us about your process. What either mentally or in your daily practice, what wisdom can you pass down to new writers about how you manage to make your books happen?
One thing is to me, every book is different. So I am also not generally an outliner, but I did outline When Franny Stands Up. I actually used a book called The 90 Day Novel, which I loved using, and I've never used it since. But at that time, I'd written two novels that just went nowhere, and I had lost a ton of confidence. And so I was like, I really need a win. Mm-hmm. I need a win, and I need some help in some way. And I came across this book, and it was really, really helpful. But now the book I'm writing is very much intuitive, and it's kind of just, you know, especially as the pandemic scrambled my brain, I just needed to do something enjoyable and fun and whatever I felt like doing that day. And so that's kind of how I started this new one. So it really, my process is very different depending on the book. But one thing that I'm trying to do is understand that productivity isn't linear. Mm-hmm. That's actually a very capitalist notion of that you're always going to be getting more efficient and better and more, and every day is going to be something new and better and great and perfect. And really, I try to give myself the grace of having fallow periods the way that a garden would, mm-hmm. That your writing will ebb and flow with the seasons, and you just kind of have to go with it, whether or not you want it to or plan to let it, it will. So you can either pathologize it and call it writer's block, or you can just be like, okay, now I'm going to take a walk today. So this is easier said than done.
Yeah.
On the days when nothing comes out, you're like, oh God, no, this mm-hmm. I'm finished. But I really try to like embody that idea of seasonal creativity, and enjoy it and enjoy the rest of my life, you know?
Yeah.
I also wanted to say something about imposter syndrome that it was really helpful for me.
Okay.
And I cannot remember where I heard this, but, thinking of it a little subversively. So rather than being like, oh God, oh, I'm no good, they're going to find me out, think of it as like, you're crashing a party that you weren't supposed to be at. And it doesn't change, like, you can't talk yourself out of imposter syndrome, but if you're like, hee hee hee,
yeah.
I'm at this party and I'm having
them all.
I fooled them all and I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to have a good time and nobody's going to know. Mm-hmm. And it's more fun to think of yourself as a party crasher.
I like that.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, I have tried to think of myself as, I succeeded in, I may be an imposter, but I succeeded, so ha. Huh.
Yep.
Jokes on them.
Yes.
I had something else I was going to say, and it's gone. That's great. Well, if you guys have any questions for Eden, tell us in the chat. Is there anything you would like to say to your old self when you were starting to write? Is it the beyond the fallow period? That's right. That's what I was going to say. That's what I was going to say. That the days where I know I'm not going to get writing done, and I go ahead and let myself not write, I'm so much happier than the days where I know I'm not going to get writing done, but I try and I fail. It's like the end result is exactly the same, except I feel a lot better when I've given myself the time to just, okay, brain doesn't want to write right now, so I can't afford to do that too many times, but apparently I need today. So I have another podcast about business in writing, and mm-hmm. so how you can't afford to have writer's block, and so writing when you can't write is kind of a pay the bills kind of concept, but some days you just can't and you need to take a break.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, I mean, it's obviously a balance, you know, like you can't, if you never wrote, then you wouldn't be a writer, right?
Exactly.
but there was this was something Cory Doctorow said to me once, which is that, you know, and to your question of like what I would say to my younger self, when I was very like emotionally caught up in my writing, being like, oh, today was a good day or today was a bad day and I wrote a bunch of crap and whatever. When you go back and look at what you've written, I defy you to be able to tell which day was the good day and which was the bad day.
Mm-hmm.
You can't tell. It's your emotions that are getting in the way of that. And so when he said that, that was like a really, I don't know. It was really eye-opening because it's absolutely true.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, sometimes I can remember how I felt when I wrote something I really, really, really liked, but not, you know, most of the days I'm like, I don't remember when I wrote that, and it doesn't seem to stand out as this was a bad day of writing, so.
And actually, the days when I'm like, this was amazing and a stroke of genius, I look back and I'm like, oh, God, no, that's terrible. So it actually sort of switched.
Yeah, Shard says, there's something really comforting to me when I hear someone else say, "Go say I forgot what I was going to say and no one gets mad at them. Thank you, Shards. I'm grateful, too. But I think I am done with my questions. The book is When Franny Stands Up. The author is Eden Robbins. You've been so kind to come here today and patient to come here today late with me.
Oh, my God. It was so fun, though. It was so fun, and it's totally fine.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you all in chat for making this a fun thing for us to be doing live. As always, I'll be back. I'm taking Wednesdays off for a little while to not do gaming. I'm just not, I don't know what it is. I'm not feeling it, and I keep missing it. So we will be back on Thursday, and more on that in the actual credits, because I wrote it down like I was preparing. Oh boy. Remember, kids, when you make your Twitch name and you want someone to write it down, make sure you make it easy to spell. Okay, I'm going to say thank you again to Eden.
Thank you.
I Should Be Writing is available to you under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Theme music by John Anilio. Art by Numbers Ninja. Production by Summer Brooks. And hosting by Libsyn. Find all of this information and more at Merverse.com. And remember, we can't do this without you. Thanks for your support.
Well, I should be writing. I should be working on my craft. I should be writing. I should be submitting my next draft. But I'm sitting home watching the doctor. Watching Doctor Who.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.